Welcome to QualityCast North, a podcast dedicated to showcasing healthcare quality improvement across northern British Columbia. Casting today from the traditional territories of the Kleklaytane and Tsintsiyan First Nations are your hosts.
I'm Cher Chewy.
And I'm Lee Cameron.
Now, the subject of today's episode might make about half our listeners squirm a little in their seats. When it comes to family planning, people and couples have multiple options to choose from, some of which are temporary and some more permanent. And one of the more permanent options is male vasectomy, a simple procedure, but one you might be surprised to hear is not 100% foolproof. Now, with a potentially life-changing outcome from its failure, how can patients who undergo vasectomy be sure that it's worked? To answer this question and to talk about his quality improvement work on the topic is our guest today, Dr. Damien Fay, a family doctor based in Hudson's Hope, Northeast BC. Hello, Damien. So glad you could join us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, to start us off, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about your background, perhaps where you grew up, and how did you end up working in North BC?
I'm sure that's always an interesting question for people. My story's a bit convoluted. I grew up in Northern Ireland, in Belfast. Went to medical school in Belfast and graduated in 2010. Took up family practice training and completed that in 2015 and decided to move to Edinburgh in Scotland, a beautiful city if you've never visited. It's stunning. Spent 3 years there working as a family doctor and as a GP with specialist interest in sexual health, where I trained in a hospital called Chalmers Hospital, which is a unique hospital in that it only does sexual reproductive health. So I took on the role as like assistant vasectomy lead and did quite a number of vasectomies in Edinburgh and the surrounding areas. And then in 2017, I met my beautiful Canadian wife in Ireland, and she tricked me into moving to Canada. So after 3 years on the beautiful East Coast in Prince Edward Island, where I set up my own vasectomy service, an old university friend convinced me to move to Hudson's Hope. He'd been working there for years and he just wanted some help, and it seemed like a good time to move to the West Coast. So here we are.
That's a great journey story, actually. And it explains a lot. And how often we actually just come change location, change jobs on the basis of a friend or a recommendation, right? So that's great. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the community where you work, Hudson's Hope, and who's on your team?
Yeah, so Hudson's Hope's a very small community. It's only 1,000 people. It's really there to support BC Hydro. There's three large hydroelectric power plants in the area, and a lot of the staff live and work in Hudson's Hope. I provide services for the surrounding areas, so Tumbler Ridge, Dawson Creek, Chetwynd, Fort St. John. Sometimes people come from further afield for vasectomy as well. And being a small community, it's a rather small team. I have a registered nurse, I have a lab technician, I work with two medical office assistants, and that's really it. You know, we're quite a close-knit but very reliable team. Sometimes it makes for, you know, great camaraderie, and sometimes it's a little like cabin fever, but we get by as best we can.
That's great. And it's a small community and it's a small facility, and yet you're the vasectomy center of Northeast BC. Is that right?
I know. People are often confused on the phone when they say, I have to go where for a vasectomy? I do travel to Fort St. John every other Saturday, and I do big clinics there, maybe 10 or 12 patients in an afternoon. But I try and stay as close to home as possible. We have a beautiful facility in Hudson, so we're very, very lucky. It's very large. There's lots of rooms. There's a state-of-the-art procedure room. So if I can get the patients to come to me, it just makes sense.
What a great issue. So now the subject of your QI project is vasectomy procedures, and it might seem a little esoteric to some. How did you realize you had a problem in this area? You know, how did that come to light?
Well, vasectomy is one of those beautiful procedures where there's a definitive endpoint. You do the procedure. 3 months later, you test the patient. If they have no sperm in their analysis, then it's successful. Obviously, there's other markers of success like patient satisfaction, complications of the procedure. But, the definitive outcome is, was the procedure successful? Is the patient now sterile? And it's a beautiful procedure in that way, because you can pat yourself on the back and say, another procedure done, another successful result, let's move on. And if you research the percentage of men that actually give post-vasectomy semen analysis samples for us. You'll get anything between, 55 and 80%. That's kind of typical. And when I worked in Scotland, I worked in Prince Edward Island, I was in the upper end of that range. I was, 70, 80% typically. When I moved to the north of BC, I was averaging below 60%. I hadn't changed my practice. I hadn't done anything different. My team in Hudson's Hope were just as good as my team anywhere else, in my opinion. So I wanted to know why this was happening, and I wanted to improve it. From a professional pride perspective, I wanted to make sure that my work was successful, but also from a patient safety perspective, they've had this once in a lifetime procedure, and I wanted to make sure that it was working for them and they weren't going to end up with unwanted pregnancies.
So you identified the problem, you had tons of experience in it. How did you set about improving this?
So it's a pretty straightforward objective. We wanted to increase the percentage of patients that return to semen analysis post-vasectomy, and we wanted to be more than 70%. But finding out how to do that was trickier, because a lot of it relies on, patient psyche. Why aren't they dropping their samples in? So the first thing I did was I spoke to my team, because we, in vasectomy, again, it's quite a unique situation. The patient's in the room with you for 20 minutes, they're awake, and they talk. And they tell you a lot about their lives, about their apprehension, about the procedure. So anecdotally, the staff were able to gather quite a lot of information from patients. So just speaking to the staff, we had some ideas of what the issues might be. For example, patient education. They didn't understand why it was important. Or access. We live in the north. It's remote. It's hard to get samples in. That was a big issue for patients. Embarrassment. People don't want to talk about giving sperm samples, semen samples. So we kind of had a meet up a list of potential reasons, and then we started surveying patients and asking them if there was other reasons why they wouldn't drop in a sample. So that's how we started. And then we tried to figure out what were the most important reasons within those reasons. And we felt that education was the big one that we could potentially alter easily. Access was number two, but changing the access involved, it wasn't a QI project. It was a different approach. We needed funding and staff and extra resources, which wasn't really within my powers. So we decided to focus on initially on patient education.
Yeah, working in your sphere of influence, right? And it sounds like a great team approach where you pulled your patients in on getting that feedback. How did the project go from your perspective? And did you manage to make progress? Were there any surprises, hiccups?
Yeah. So I'd love to sit here and tell you that it was perfect and that it was easy and we got to 70%. Initially, we had some clear ideas about how to educate the patients. So we started by educating them before the procedure via email. We'd send them videos. We'd send them written information. That didn't really change the percentage of patients giving us samples back. So with that improvement, we went from maybe 50 to 54%, and that wasn't anywhere near our target. So then we started having a one-on-one education session with the medical office assistant after the procedure, and that brought us up to about 56%, so very, very marginal increases. And then we started sending patients home with written information as well as sending them information before, educating them in person, then sending them home with written information, and that got us up to 62%. When that didn't get us there, 70%, we then started calling patients after 3 months and asking them why they hadn't dropped in a sample and if they would, be willing to. So as it currently stands, we are at around 64-65% return, and that is up from, just above 50%. It's not quite at the 70%, but it's better. And although this project's been going on for almost 2 years, it is a lifelong project for me because, I consistently want to improve the amount of patients returning these samples. So yeah, we didn't quite get to where we wanted to be, but we're still trying really hard and we have seen some improvement. So yeah, it's been positive, but not perfect.
Well, it sounds like you were tenacious in your methodology, in trying change idea after change idea to get yourself just a little incrementally closer to your goal. And it's unfortunately you didn't meet your goal, but you did make good progress, undoubtedly, about that. But I'm interested because you in your last practice in on the East Coast, you managed to get your percentages right up there, and despite quite a well-performed and methodological QI project in your current practice, you still are coming up a little short. Do you have any ideas why that might be?
I have two. The first one is access, which I haven't really been able to change yet. Some of my patients are coming from Fort Nelson. It's a 5-hour drive away, and Fort Nelson doesn't have the ability to analyze semen samples. So in order for a Fort Nelson patient to submit a sample, they have to drive to Fort St. John, rent a hotel room, produce a sample, and then drive back to Fort Nelson. So obviously that comes with time and cost. Also, there are patients that work out in the bush. They work in camps or they work in mines. It's difficult for them to schedule this in. So that's one of the main issues. The other thing I've noticed between Prince Edward Island, Scotland, and the northeast is the demographic of people. A lot of the patients I perform vasectomies on the East Coast and in Scotland were college educated professionals. In the Northeast, there's not as many of those type of jobs around. Whether that's an issue, I don't know, but it is one big thing that stands out that could potentially be a factor. And that's one of the reasons I focused on education, because I thought that would help change that if it was an issue. And we did make some progress, so maybe I'm onto something, but I obviously I can't change the demographic.
Did you come out away from the project with any other good learning experiences or takeaways? What's been the impact of this project on yourself and on your practice?
Well, you'd reflect on the practice or the project, sorry. I did meet my goals, but I did see improvements, and none of my change ideas resulted in a negative. So I'm proud of that. From learning experiences, I suppose when I started the project, I thought it'd be very easy. I thought that I knew my patients really well, and I've been doing this for a long time, and I knew what change ideas would show instant success. So I guess I don't know my patients as well as I thought. I also thought I understood, the psyche of the vasectomy patient, and I think it was a little bit naive in that perspective as well. So I am trying to listen to what my patients say more, trying to be more open-minded about their concerns, and yet see if I can understand their apprehensions a little bit better. I suppose if I was doing it again, I would spend more time surveying the patients at the start. I did do that, but maybe gathering more data would help me address their concerns. The final kind of thing I learned about GI projects in general was that don't be too hard on myself. I didn't reach my target, and that's disappointing, but we saw a lot of progress. So I'm pretty pleased with that, and it's still an ongoing cycle, so maybe one day I'll hit 70%, but I'll keep trying hard.
Yeah, well, you should be very proud of yourself. I think that's a really, really good result, despite the constraints that you've got. And the learning points that you mentioned are all excellent, actually. And you've illustrated one of the harsh realities of quality improvement, and that is that QI is hard, right? It's very contextual. Every community is going to be different. Every QI project is therefore going to be different, and it's hard work. So credit to you for taking that on. Now, I think you might have answered this already, but if there are any other physicians out there in a similar situation to yourself, who are listening to this and they might like to do something similar, what advice would you give them?
So as a QI project, I suppose you're limited in terms of, you can't change some of the biggest factors, and that's fine, and you have to accept that. It was quite irritating to me because there was other things I wish I could have changed that were outside of my scope, like access. So bear that in mind before you start your project. You can't control everything. Don't be too hard on yourself. Listen to your patients. They know why they won't give samples. They know why they're doing what they do. So if you can give them time to express that, I think you'll learn a lot.
Excellent. That's great advice.
So Damien, this project was supported by the Northern Health Physician Quality Improvement Initiative. And how did they assist you with this work?
Well, this was my first official quality improvement project. I think, you know, a lot of people in their careers will do accidental miniature quality improvement projects, but this was my first kind of official one where I just finished learning about QI, and it was my first project implementing it. So it was great to bounce ideas off the staff, you know, Lee and Heather in particular. It was great to get feedback, you know, what I was doing well, what I wasn't doing well, and also just ideas for, you know, other change ideas. Because, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I'm very tunnel visioned. So it is always nice to get an outside perspective. People that are thinking just a little bit differently than you, particularly if you're a specialist and you're doing a QI project, you probably think about your specialty in a linear capacity. Speaking to a non-ophthalmologist, non-neurologist might just give you a different perspective to help you think of something you haven't thought of before.
What do you enjoy about living and working in a small rural northern BC community? And with that, how do you relax when you're away from work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think rural family medicine is as rewarding as it's difficult. It's a full scope job. You do everything. The lack of local specialists can be a challenge, but also be quite exhilarating. You end up doing a lot of things that you wouldn't be doing if you lived in a big city. So you really are practicing full scope. And it's opportunity to educate yourself. I can't refer to the local dermatologist or plastic surgeon. You know, it's a 2-year wait and a 4-hour drive to plastic surgery. So you end up doing a lot of things that, you know, you wouldn't do in a big city. And that, to me, that's super rewarding. It's enjoyable. It keeps me on my toes. And it's the reason I like working in a remote community. Plus, I know my patients really well. I have 1,000 patients. They're quite a small panel. A patient walks in, I rarely have to look at their chart. I know pretty much everything about them. I know what medication they're on. I know who their sister is. I know where her son works. You know, it's quite rewarding in that regard. Away from work, I do triathlon. So in the summer, the north's a brilliant place to live. I can run through the hills with bear spray. I can swim in the lakes and avoid leeches. And I can cycle on the rural remote roads and not see cars for hours. So it's a triathlete's paradise in the summer. In the winter, not so much. But yeah, the summers are super up there. Oh, and beer. I like craft beer. But who doesn't?
Who doesn't? That's a great answer. And you know, that's a real draw. So well done for that. Thank you for that, and for a good plug for the North there, especially for all those triathletes out there. And I can sympathize with some of those other perils of being in the bush as well.
I mean, if you're out for a run and you know that there's bears in the area and you have to get your 15K in, you know, you're going to get that 15K in pretty quick. The longer you're out there, the longer the bears have to smell your sweat. So you run pretty fast.
Another benefit from reducing your track times by training in the north. I don't think anyone has ever mentioned that particular benefit of living in the north. How about that? That's great. But and slightly more seriously, you actually mentioned one of the great things about rural practice is knowing your patients, particularly in this current climate where so many patients don't have a family doctor. And the doctors who do see patients in walk-in clinics or in emergency departments really don't know their patients to the same depth. So that is one benefit of rural medicine for sure.
And I think with, you know, patients becoming increasingly complex, if I didn't know the patient they walked through the door, I might spend 30 minutes reading their chart. The fact that I know them pretty well saves me a lot of time, saves the patient a lot of time and a lot of confusion. Continuity of care is... the more complex patient gets, the more important continuity of care becomes. So yeah, it is challenging, but rewarding. And for anybody starting out, particularly new grads from family residency, there's no better place to cut your teeth than in remote places. You'll get such exposure, you'll learn so much. And even if you're only there for a few years, the benefits the rest of your career are just huge.
Well, I'll take that as a recommendation for rural medicine Well done. Well done, Damien. Okay. Well, that rounds out our interview today. So that's a really wonderful high point to come out on. I can hear the closing music, which means that is actually all we have time for, and we have to wrap things up. But thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Damien Fay. And we'll be sending you one of our exclusive and highly coveted Quality Cast North coffee mugs as a token of our thanks. So look out for that one in the post. For our listeners, please join us next time. Until then, I'm Cher Chewy.
And I'm Lee Cameron.
And you've been listening to Quality Cast North. If you enjoyed today's episode, check out our other episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts, and subscribe to our channel. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a question for us about healthcare quality improvement, email us at qualitycomms@northernhealth.ca, and your question could feature on a future episode. QualityCast North is sponsored by the Physician Quality Improvement Initiative, or PQI. PQI is a flagship program of the Specialist Services Committee, a collaboration between the Provincial Ministry of Health and the Doctors of BC, with representation with the provincial health authorities. This episode was co-produced by Dr. Cher Chewy and Lee Cameron, with technical support from Levi Giles and Matt Walker of Expression North. Original music by Daniel Chewy. Further information about today's guest is available in our show notes on our website at nhpqi.ca.